Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Sunday, September 21st, 2014, on the Premier Networks. This is episode 1120. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with Citrix ShareFile. Try ShareFile today for a 30-day free trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click the microphone, and enter Tech Guy. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. Well, hey, how you today? How you? I'm really... oh, boy. Going to be a man of few words today. How are you today, Leo Laporte, the tech guy? Time to talk high tech at 8888-ASK-LEO. We talk about computers and the internet, smartphones, home theater, digital photography, all that jazz every weekend here. And I'll admit it, I'm suffering from an iPhone hangover. I got in line at the Apple store at 3 a.m. on Friday so that I'd be there when the store opened at 8 a.m. because Apple's online ordering system didn't work the week before and I wasn't able to get one. And I had to have it for today. I had to have it for you, the people. So I'm a little tired. I couldn't get back to sleep. I kind of got excited. So you get the iPhone. Now you start to play with the iPhone. And I don't think I've slept well for the last couple of nights. Just because I think I'm really done maybe with the iPhone. I don't know. So here are the new iPhones. I'm holding them for those of you who cannot see. And since we're on the radio, that's all of you. I'm holding them in my hands. The new iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. It's okay, Siri. We'll talk later. The 6 and 6 Plus. You know what? They're beautiful. And this Apple does this every time. I have to do this in a Johnny Ive voice. These are the thinnest iPhones we've ever made. They also say every year, this is the best iPhone we've ever made. Like you would make the worst iPhone? Like you would make it worse? No, every year you should make it better. This seems obvious. But they do really like the thinness. And of course, I may not be alone. I wouldn't mind it if it were a skosh thicker, if it had better battery life. They do claim better battery life on this. It is much faster. They have a new chip, the A8 chip. Apple doesn't release a lot of information about what's in that chip. But one thing some are saying is that this is the first non-Samsung chip running an iPhone. That would be interesting. Of course, Apple and Samsung have had their differences in court. And I think Apple would also very much like to have other people supplying the chips for its phones, people other than its number one competitor in the phone market. This chip is very amazing. I mean, it has 2 billion transistors. Billion, not million, billion transistors in this tiny little chip, the size of your pinky nail. Not the pinky itself, your pinky nail. 20 nanometer process, so it's very tiny. That's good, actually. That means it's fuel efficient. It's very fast. The screen's, of course, a little bit bigger, 4.7 inches for the iPhone 6. That's up from 4 inches for the 5 and 5S, and 5.5 inches for the iPhone 6 Plus. Now, a couple of thoughts after having played with this for a few days. Two things strike me. One, we now have, and I mentioned this on the last show, a tie in the phone race. I don't think you can say any longer that Apple is somehow behind Android, certainly not in screen size, nor can you say that Android is somehow magically ahead of Apple. They have better things in certain areas. The fingerprint reader on the iPhone works better than anybody else's and is spectacular and is a really great idea that's going to facilitate electronic payments. That's a good thing. The cameras still on the iPhone, despite the fact that they're only 8 megapixels, the best cameras in smartphones, even better than, and you could argue this, but I think even better than the Nokia cameras, which are very, very good indeed. Although, I think at this point, and then Android has some other features that are better. I think it's much better to be able to change your screen launcher so you can customize an Android phone so much more easily and in so many better ways. But ultimately, I think it's now a tie. It's now a matter of personal choice. I don't think anybody could say my phone is better than your phone. So if somebody says that, you just say, stop it. It's not. Leo says it's not. That you should pick the phone you like. So there, neener, neener, neener. Because it really, it is now a pure matter of taste. There are certainly advantages in each side. Interchangeable battery on Samsung phones. That's nice. So if some people, that's really important. Some people, it's not. There are things to like on both. I don't think one has a substantial lead on the other. My other thought after playing with this for a while, I thought for sure, having used for the last couple of years giant Android phones, starting with the Galaxy Note 2 at 5 inches and the HTC One at 5 inches, using larger phones, the Note 3, the Lumia 1520, the Windows phone, it's at 6 inches. I have used big phones. I am a man of big phones. I'm a big man with big, fat, chubby fingers, and I like it a big phone. I do. And so I thought, oh, for sure, this is huge. I'm going to be able to get an iPhone finally that is a phablet as big as it, almost a small tablet. My daughter Abby said, this is halfway to a tablet. She's right. It's big. I don't like it. I surprising myself, I think 4.7 inches is really the ideal size. And especially if you're coming from an iPhone 5 or 5S or heaven forfend a 4 or 4S, I think you will very much prefer the smaller size. And in fact, it seems to be that the smaller size is selling better than the big size. We thought everybody'd want the 6 Plus. And iPhone users are smart. They go, that's a very big phone. And at least on iOS, and I think maybe this is it. On Android, it's a little different. You can use the real estate differently. You can use widgets and you can, instead of just an array of icons, the interface on the phone, the front page on the phone can be all sorts of stuff. You know, it can be pages from your news sources or newspapers with big color pictures. You can have clocks and you can have all sorts of stuff. And so you can having that extra real estate is really great. On the iPhone, it's just more icons. And then when you open an application, the application's bigger. And partly this is the success of Apple. The iPhone 6, the 4.7-inch iPhone, is a little jewel. It's beautiful. It's perfect. Now, remember that for a long time I carried the Moto X, which was also 4.7 inches. And I felt I think this might be the ideal size for a phone. It's small enough that you can still kind of palm it comfortably and you can almost use it with one finger, and but it's big enough that you can see things clearly, and it's easy to navigate, easy to type. I think for iOS especially, 5.5 inches, Apple might have gone too big. What do you think? Too big? Now, one of the advantages of a giant phone is you can put a giant battery in it. It's an interesting challenge because you also have to have a giant screen, and that means you're using more battery. But I think Apple's own numbers confirm, and my early results confirm, that you do get maybe 25 or 30% more battery life on the big phone. So if battery life is important, and I know on iPhones it is because we use them so much, we run through them, then it might be worth getting the bigger phone. But there are things, a lot of people, for instance, say, well, I really want to have an SD card in my phone. That would be really great. True, because then you can add storage. You can take it out and hook it up to your computer and copy stuff around. There are pros and cons on each, and unfortunately, the days when I could say, get phone X, it's the best, there's no question, it's not a competition, those days are gone. It was easy. In 2007, it was easy. You need a smartphone, you get an iPhone on AT&T. That's your choice. You have no other choice. And it was that way for a couple of years. But Apple has done some interesting things. Apple has caught up in some ways. Android has done some... In many ways, I think Android's grown faster than Apple. And the Android choices are remarkable. You have choice. That's a good thing. We should celebrate that. And you can go to the phone store now and be totally and utterly confused by this stuff out there. It's funny, though. Already the Apple fans are starting to complain about the new screen sizes because most of the apps have not yet been redesigned to match these new screen resolutions. They're zoomed up. And people are saying, oh, they're ugly. Oh, welcome to the world of fragmentation. 8888 Ask Leo, what do you think? This is your chance to talk. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We're talking high tech, talking about computers, talking about the internets. Somebody in the chat room said, I don't care about smartphones. Let's talk about NVIDIA video cards. Those days, I think, are a little bit gone. Sad to say, I've been doing this so long now, since the early 90s. And, of course, there were many years in there where we were talking about IRQ interrupt conflicts. Fortunately, none of you know what that is, and that's a good thing. You don't have to worry about it anymore if you're a PC user. And then we spent many years talking about what the best video cards were. We don't really have to worry about that much anymore. Unless you're a hardcore gamer, you don't care. And I think even hardcore gamers at this point probably don't need to worry about it. Times move on. Times move on. Sure, you might have a tube amplifier, a Macintosh with 250 watts RMS per channel, but nobody's talking about that anymore. Let's go to Michael in Shelby Township, which is in Michigan, a beautiful place in the country. What can I do for you, Michael?
Hey, Leo, how are you this afternoon?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing really good. Let me say I'm a longtime fan. Been watching you since the Screensavers. I really miss Kate and her crazy kicks.
She's great. She's in Michigan now. You know, she's in Traverse City.
Yeah, it's not too far. It's up north, actually. Yeah. About maybe a few hours away from me.
Yeah, she's very happy.
You know, let me be brief in asking my question. Since the recent release of iOS 8, there has been an explosion of third-party keyboards in the App Store.
Yes.
In regards to that, there's a lot of people concerned, myself as well, for security purposes.
Yeah, so, I'll talk about it. This is a good question, and actually Apple shares your concern. To my intense annoyance, when I switch to a password entry field, it switches back to the Apple keyboard. One of the reasons I stopped using an iPhone is I consider Apple's keyboard substandard. The Android keyboards have taken great strides, and the one I use both on Android and on Apple is SwiftKey. It's probably the number one keyboard, third-party keyboard for Apple already. There are other choices like Flexi or FlexKey, whatever it's called. Swipe is very, very popular. But SwiftKey is free, and I would start with SwiftKey. SwiftKey has a couple of features that, in my opinion, make a huge difference. Number one is it has a swiping. So instead of tapping the letters, T-H-E-D-O-G, you move your finger without lifting it from the screen, from T-H-E to space to D-O-G, and the keyboard magically knows what you're typing. It's, in my opinion, a much more accurate way and certainly a lot faster way to type on a keyboard. So that simply by itself argues, I think, for a third-party keyboard on the iPhone. I have never understood why Apple, to this day, on their keyboard, it's always uppercase. Whatever you're typing doesn't matter. The keycaps are always uppercase, and I find that confusing. And there's no every keyboard in the world, including all the third-party keyboards for iOS, will, when you're in lowercase, show a lowercase letter. It is a computer. We can change this now. And when you're in uppercase, it's an uppercase. Now, your concern, though, is, and Apple warns you, in fact, I think they're really scaring people, to Google's account, they also warn you that any keyboard can capture your keystrokes and send it back to the home office. That's
correct.
Yes. By the way, so can Apple's, but the only home office it can send it to is Apple.
Right.
So Apple, so it's a little disingenuous because, we trust ourselves. Well, do I trust you? I guess I have to. And that's the key. When you use software, you have to trust it because it's not just the keyboard. Any program on that phone could send all sorts of stuff back to the home office. That's the nature of software. They're black boxes. And when you're using a device that's always connected to the internet, anything's possible. So there is a huge amount of trust when you use software, period. That's always the case.
Absolutely. And, you know, the reason why I ask this question is because this has exploded all over the forums.
I'm trying to talk people down off the ledge. First of all, I don't know if I could trust SwiftKey. I've trusted them for years. The real risk would be, of course, they can capture logins and passwords. And people are worried that any keyboard, including, by the way, the keyboard on your computer, can be a keystroke logger. That's absolutely true. And so can Apple's, and you've been trusting Apple's all this time. Apple still, and this really bothers me because I frankly find this even more of an offensive user interface problem. Apple will switch keyboards when you enter passwords. Well, you trust us, so we're going to use our keyboard, even though you've chosen and accepted another keyboard. I find that offensive. And it's and by the way, extremely confusing. And the times that I need a better keyboard are precisely when I'm typing passwords, because I use a mix of upper and lowercase letters, and it's very easy to lose track of where you are on the Apple keyboard. And sure, that's one of the reasons I left iPhone in the first place. So I've been using SwiftKey on Android. So far, to my knowledge, I've never stolen my password. I know the guys who do SwiftKey. You can trust them.
Well, that's the whole thing.
You can trust them.
That's why I want to ask these questions, because the three I'm considering would be SwiftKey, would be Swipe, and would be FlexKey. Thing is,
I would go with SwiftKey.
Well, SwiftKey has been known, though, to, you know, take this data and collect this data.
And all right, well, I give up then. Don't go use Apple's keyboard. You know what? If that's what people want, use Apple's keyboard. Nobody's making you use a third-party keyboard. SwiftKey has been known to take people's data. I don't even know where to start on that. SwiftKey has a feature, and I turn it on, that allows them access to your email, your Facebook, your tweets, and other stuff so that they can learn your typing style, learn a dictionary of words that you use frequently. I find that useful. If you don't, and you like the crap keyboard that Apple has foisted upon us, please, by all means, use it. You, of course, are now trusting Apple. Oh, and by the way, all of those things are sent over the internet. You're trusting your phone company. You're trusting any internet servers along the way. And you're ultimately trusting the company you give your password to. Like, let's say, Home Depot and Target. We live in a civilization is based on trust. You trust that the driver coming the other direction down the street will not at the last moment turn his wheel and plow his 2-ton vehicle straight into your face every minute you drive. If you are an untrusting person, you should go live in a cabin in the woods and hope the bears don't eat you, because we have to trust every bit of software that you use can be malicious and take advantage of you. It's the nature of software. They're all black boxes, not just the keyboards. They're all black boxes. And I kind of think Apple is, I guess they feel that they have to put this big warning. Well, you know, this company could be collecting all this data that you're giving them access to. And Android does the same thing. Be careful using these third-party keyboards. I trust them. Don't worry about it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by our good friends at ShareFile. This is another thing, another tool that I use every week with the radio show. I have to get audio, you know, tracks to the radio stations, and I've tried lots of ways of doing this. Of course, anytime you're in business, you're probably sharing files in business. And what is the first way you try? Email attachments. What is the first thing Leo says every time? Don't use attachments. Don't open them. Don't send them. It's the way viruses get spread. But there's another problem with email attachments. There's several. Of course, email attachments aren't secure. That's a big problem, right? Everybody along the way can see them. There's no privacy. It's like sending a postcard. And the files we're sending, PowerPoint presentations, contracts, PDFs, they're often so big they get bounced back. ShareFile solves that. That's why 99% of the Fortune 500 use ShareFile instead of email attachments. No more bounce backs, no more file size restrictions, no more hassles, and you're secure. You, in fact, don't lose control of the file because You control who has access, how many, what their permissions are, how long they can download it for. You confirm when files are received with tracking and email alerts. And your files are always available to you. ShareFile synchronizes your files to the cloud, so I use the free ShareFile app, and I can send my files via that, even download them. We use ShareFile all the time. Let me log into my ShareFile account just to prove it. One of the things you'll notice with ShareFile is it looks like it's got my branding. It looks like my site. And that's great because I think when somebody's getting a file from you, you want them to know it's from you and not think, well, what is ShareFile? Is this safe? You don't want that issue. It's very easy for them to use. This is my interface for ShareFile. You see, I can also request a file via ShareFile, which is great. I'll open the Premiere folder because that's the radio show. These people have access to it. In fact, some of them automatically get emails whenever I upload a new file. That simplifies my life. Here's some recordings. Let's say I want to send this. I'll click it and send. Now, you can send from the web interface. They also have an Outlook plugin. This makes it very easy. It looks like email attachment. What you'll get here is all the controls, how long that download's good for, how many times they can download it, what you need to know, like what their email address is and so forth. You'll get a link which you can paste in the email. They'll see that email link, and then they click it, and this is what they see. They see a page with your branding, which I love, and a big download button. They see what the file is, how big it is. That's what they see. And I'll tell you what, anybody can figure that out. They don't have to sign up. They don't have to log in. They just makes it very easy. I love ShareFile. I think your business should be using it, and that's why we've got a 30-day free trial for you. Visit ShareFile.com. Click the microphone at the top there, which says podcast listeners. Click that. Because this is, we want to get credit for it. And enter the offer code, one word, tech guy. Choose your business too, because they'll customize it. It's HIPAA compliant, compliant with financial regulations and also, you know, all of the different federal and other regulations for privacy. It's compliant. But choose your industry so it'll customize it for you. ShareFile.com. Click the microphone and enter the offer code, tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo's the number. You know, Apple users have been in this iPhone users for a long time have been in this kind of protective cocoon where you did have to trust, but all you had to do was really trust Apple. And I think Apple's trustworthy. I think any big company, any big publicly traded company is trustworthy because there are plenty of people out there all the time. Lots of white hat hackers who are constantly banging on stuff, watching the traffic that's coming out of things, and they have, you know, bully pulpits, and they will shout to the high heavens if any shenanigans occur. So you can trust the big names only because they're being kept honest by a legion of hackers and security researchers who are constantly looking for misbehavior. We know that because any misbehavior is immediately reported. And when you're a publicly traded company, you have a higher duty, a fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders not to bring the company to its knees by doing something silly like spying on people. So we trust Apple. And Apple users have been able to trust Apple. And Apple really had a very a strong security model on the iPhone. iPhone apps were effectively isolated from every other app. No shared data. There's no file system that you can easily explore. I mean, this was, and still there were flaws. I mean, nothing's perfect. There is no such thing as flawless security, but Apple worked very hard to do it. And with the release of iPhone 5 and now iOS 8, they've done even more. The new iPhone 6 has some amazing security features built into it, primarily so that you'll trust it with your wallet, because that's one of the things Apple wants you to do with Apple Pay is put all your financial information in there. And use your iPhone as a wallet. So if you're an iPhone user and you love your iPhone, you've been in this cocoon and you've said, well, look, I made the calculation. I trust Apple. And that's all I have to think about. But now Apple, in order to keep up with the rest of the world, has started to let in a few slowly, carefully, judiciously, I believe, a few little things like third-party keyboards. Now, in applications can communicate within one another. That's going to be great. Something called extensions. For instance, let's say well, it's not been much implemented yet. These are brand new. But in some date in the future, you'll be using, let's say, your camera program, and you'll be able to send it directly from Instagram from your camera program. Right now, what you have to do is either take the picture in Instagram or save the picture and open it from Instagram. But all that's going to be much more seamless because Apple has kind of opened it up a little bit to allow applications to talk to one another. Oh, my goodness. Shocking. Partly they did this because of market pressures. You know, people want this. And Apple's trying to do it in a way that is secure as possible. In fact, Apple finally has caught on. I've been saying for some years that really Apple's best marketing message should be, we are private. You can trust us. We won't sell your information. And other guys might or will. And so you should trust us. And Apple, in fact, is now in the last, with the release of the iPhone 6 the last week, been saying that. Tim Cook's actually given interviews with those exact words. You can trust us. You can't trust the other guys. Our business is selling you hardware. The other guy's business is selling ads. He's talking, of course, about Google and Facebook. It's a good story. It's a great marketing message. It's not strictly true. Apple does, in fact, sell ads. You know, they do make money now, not just from hardware, but from services like iCloud, like iTunes, and like iAds. So it's not a pure story, but it's pure enough. It's good marketing. And you can see from our last caller, this is something people want. People want privacy. They want to trust somebody. I guess my only message is, look, Apple is a company, a profit-making company. Here's one thing you can trust of any company. They want to make money from you, period. I do, they do, any business does. That's what business is, period. And you should trust them only as far as you can keep an eye on them, because if there's a way to make more money, maybe just, you know, a little bit more money by maybe selling some information for better ads, they might do that. They might do that. They do that. Jim in Atlanta, I'm sorry, that was Jim in Atlanta. Jerry in Fallbrook, California, Laporte.
Old guy, I'm Jerry, and I do trust you.
Well, I try to be trustworthy.
You got it. I'm a little confused about my next step, which will be some sort of computer TV. I have Dish, and I was over at a friend's house, and he was downloading all sorts of YouTube stuff. And he said, you know, you got to get one of these Apple TV boxes.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what's a Roku and what's a Wii?
So there are a lot of these, aren't they, now? It's become a very rich choice for you.
Well, it's confusing for a guy my age.
Yeah. So all of these devices, we call them set-top boxes. It's not kind of strictly true, but that all of them are designed to do one thing, to connect your television to the Internet so that you can watch some, none of them do all, of the vast array of programming that's on the Internet.
Now, you know, my download through my Internet, I live in a little pocket in Fallbrook, so I'm on a copper DSL, which only gives me 6 megabytes of download, and I don't know if that's even fast enough to get TV, but that was my second question.
Well, it's a good question. You know, it works best if you have more speed. If you have a true 6 megabit connection, you're fine.
Okay.
You could watch, high def, not super high def, but high def quality content on any of these boxes. But remember, when somebody else is using it in your house, that's bringing it down. If you're also using it for your phone or some other services, that's bringing the total down. So it's 6 megabits, but it might be shared. Anyway, I think it's enough to try it. It's not ideal. I generally would love to see somebody have at least 10 megabits, maybe even more, but 6 should be enough.
But what am I trying? Am I trying Roku, Apple TV, or?
Well, I'll kind of tell you all of them are essentially the same idea, except they have access to different services, and that's kind of how you should make your choice. Roku is generally my first choice, except that Roku can't do one thing that the Apple TV can do, which is iTunes, Apple's own services. So if you're everything does Netflix. Apple doesn't do Amazon. It's hard for me to keep track of all this, by the way.
That's why I call
Roku does. Well, you're going to have to go to the websites and look at what services. Are you currently buying and renting TV shows, movies, and music from Apple's iTunes store?
No, I'm not. I have Dish. I subscribe to HBO and a couple of other premium stuff.
Okay.
But I like the idea of being able to see some old TV programs or TV series that I've either missed in the past and I would like to see.
Well, so you're going to have to do a little research to say, what is it that I want on the internet? YouTube, almost everybody does YouTube. Although there was a period of time, quite a long period of time, where Roku did not. But almost everybody does YouTube now. Here's one advantage Apple TV has. Because Apple, again, this is Apple saying, well, we care about your customer experience more than those other guys. We are going to do our own content distribution network for Netflix. Apple's probably the best way to watch Netflix. But there are things the Apple TV cannot do that the Roku can. And the biggest thing that nobody can do but Apple is Apple's own stuff. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. I didn't even mention, I mean, we were talking with Jerry about what to hook up to his TV to give him internet access. And I didn't mention, it's so confusing. There's so many devices. I mentioned Roku, Apple TV, but I didn't mention Google's Chromecast, which in many ways is very innovative, but still has a dearth of channels, but more coming all the time, and I think has a bright future. I didn't mention Amazon's Fire TV, which has Android games and stuff and kids stuff. There are some really great choices. If you had kids, I would get a Fire TV. Everything has Netflix, right? Apple TV is starting to look a little old, and I have a feeling they're going to announce a new one sometime. Maybe not next month, but soon. Roku, I just love Roku. It's hard for me to pick one for you. Because you have to see what channels you want to watch and which one has the channels you want. Now, he said he wanted old-time TV shows. This is where it gets even worse. Almost all of them have, for instance, HBO Go on it, which is HBO's internet-based application. But depending on your cable provider, HBO Go works. I'm Comcast. It works on the Apple TV, but not the Roku. Because Comcast has said to... I don't know what the deal is. Maybe Apple's... I don't know what the deal is. But there's no way of knowing that, really, ahead of time. They both have the HBO Go application, but Comcast won't let you use it on a Roku, at least the last time I checked. Maybe that's changed. So that even adds to the confusion. Turner Classic Movies has an app. Some of these devices will play that. It's extremely confusing. I think the only reason to get Apple TV is if you're into iTunes. Amazon is so important to me. Amazon streaming, that's what I'm looking for. Chromecast does that very well, but you need an Android or iOS device. The way Chromecast works is a little different. It hooks up to your TV. It's wirelessly on the internet. And then you use a smartphone or tablet to control it. You go to Netflix app there and press the Chromecast button and it sends it over to the TV. It's kind of a different model, a little bit complicated. Chromecast does do HBO Go now, depending on your cable company, because that's the problem with HBO Go. You not only need to have the app and the hardware, you need to have the approval of your particular cable company, and some of them approve it and some of them don't. So, Jerry, I'm not much help. I would say if you had, put me in the spot, get a Roku. The Roku 3 is great. It has some features that are remarkable, like a headphone jack in the remote. So it's great for late night listening or listening in a household where there's other people and you don't want to bother them. The Fire TV you can talk to. It has voice search. I don't know how great that is, but some people like that. I personally use my Xbox One to watch a lot of this stuff because it's also a media center. And I should point out, almost all new TVs have their own interfaces to the internet. Almost all new TVs connect to the internet too. Usually their interfaces are not... I've yet to see one that's really as good as a Roku or an Apple TV. Not much help, am I, Jerry? Jim in Atlanta. Hi, Jim. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Sorry about that.
Hey, Leo. I hung up on you.
Thanks for calling.
I didn't know if it was you or me.
I pushed the wrong button. I'm glad you got right back in, though.
Yeah, because I was amazed that I was able to watch you on the computer and also talk to you through Google Hangouts at the same time. And then I thought, well, maybe that was a conflict.
Are you on Google Hangouts right now?
I actually pulled it down because I wasn't sure.
I don't think it's a conflict.
That was what disconnected us.
So, no, it was me. It was Leo's big thumb. I said I had pudgy fingers. What can I do for you?
I used to do webcasting back when you were still on Tech TV. And
wow, you are a pioneer, my friend.
Well, I was, but they had to box everything up. The family and the job took over, and after about 100 shows, I had to step away from it. But
what were you doing? Tell me what you were doing. I'm curious.
What was I doing?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a firefighter for the city of Atlanta, and I got elected union president, and I had two kids at the same time.
No, not what were you doing. But what was your show? What was the show about?
I was doing politics and current events.
That's awesome.
Politics.
And so your idea was it almost internet community access, kind of?
No. It was national politics, and I had national guests on. Back in those days, it was so new that you could ask a big name guests to come on, and they would, because they didn't know the difference between you and a terrestrial radio.
That's awesome.
So I had candidates for president on. I had
fantastic, Jim.
It was a lot of fun.
What was the name of the show?
It was America First Radio with Jim Dawes.
I love it. So you were a pioneer. I hail you because
back on the time machine and see it, but all of the audio files are gone.
Oh man.
And that shame, and the computer that I had them stored on got stolen out of a car.
So that's terrible. So the times have come that you want to do this again?
Right. I started unboxing everything, and I didn't want to build a sound studio, and I knew that's a big thing. And so I started doing some research, and I saw you on an old podcasting show saying that you, in your first home studio, you use a Sennheiser HMD-25.
Yeah, and I don't recommend those anymore. But that was, if you watch Monday Night Football, you'll see the announcers wearing those headphones with the big microphone in front of them. That's it.
Right. Well, what would you recommend?
And those are great because you're close mic'd, and of course, an announcer at a football game, it's loud, and they can still be heard, and so it works quite well. But I'm not crazy about it. What we use now, I find more comfortable for me because I don't have to wear the headsets anymore, and I think better sound. These are radio style microphones that are highly directional. So they work fine even without any soundproofing in the room. If I go off axis, if I don't talk right down the barrel of it, I'm going to do it right now. I'm going to turn it sideways. My voice disappears almost immediately.
Some of those super carotid broadcast quality.
No, that's a condenser. You don't want it. You want a directional mic, but you want a dynamic mic. Condenser mics, the ones that need power, are too sensitive.
I didn't know that super carotid and condenser were.
Well, most of the super carotids are. So if it's a dynamic mic, then that's fine. They're just carotid means heart shaped. It's got a heart shaped pattern. That's what it means. But usually when they say that, they're condenser mics.
So tell me what I want again.
Well, the one I use and I recommend highly, it's from a guy named Bob Heil. He was a rock and roll sound guy. And he makes the best studio mics, in my opinion, for very affordable. They're about $350, called the Heil, H-E-I-L Sound, heilsound.com, PR40. You have a great voice for it, too. You have a nice, deep, rich voice, and it will sound really great on this.
That is very flattering. I've got one more question. In the old days, I used to use an analog mixing board. I subsequently bought a digital mixing board when I thought I was going to get back into it, but didn't. But are we to the point now where I can just bypass the mixing board and get a USB mic and
sure.
go directly in?
Any mic and use a USB interface, but only one mic at a time. So if it's you and you alone, no problem.
Well, it's not going to be me and me alone. Right. What I was hoping is that I could have the guests on the screen and me plugged into the computer via USB microphone and all communicate and
Now you're getting kind of complicated. You want to have the guests on I don't want to spend too much time describing how to do this because it's kind of a specialty. But now it's getting complicated. Let me put it this way. We built $1.5 million studio to do this. Now you don't have to do that, but it is getting more complicated. Skype or Google Hangouts. Now, the nice thing, I'll tell you what, this is probably, if I were you, what I would investigate. Google Hangouts on Air, which allow you to have up to 8 guests, each of them in their own window. Whoever's talking goes to the big window. But the beauty is you flip a switch and it's automatically saved out to YouTube. So now you can do effectively a television show, save it to YouTube. Google pays all the bandwidth costs because YouTube's free for you to use. Plus, you've got built-in monetization through YouTube's advertising model. I think that's, if I were starting out today, I might be doing that. So investigate, since I think you probably know about it since you're using Hangouts on Air. And if you have, I think, you know, if you're going to have more than one person in the studio with you, you're going to need a mixer. But if the other people are on Hangouts on Air, you just do it on your computer. Having a good mic will help you, and a good camera will help you. Maybe get your co-host to do the same. We'll get back to your calls and the commercial after this break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by our good friends at Prosper.com. I love this idea. You know, progress happens because people think of great ideas, and we live in a world where the internet and the way technology has evolved facilitates this, and it's so great. This is an example of something that has not worked for years, the big bank loan, where you have to go put on a necktie, put on pants, put a hat in hand, and beg for money. Please, sir, can I have some money? And it turns out that's not necessary anymore, thanks to the internet. And companies like Prosper, actually, I don't know of any other company. This is Prosper, is the one that does it. Prosper brings together people with money to lend with people who need to borrow money, which is a great idea. In fact, they now have more than 2 million members, lenders and borrowers alike. They have $1 billion in funded loans. That's how good an idea this is. Imagine if you could get 35 grand in the next 3 days. What would you do? Would you pay off your high-rate credit cards? Yeah, that would be a good one. Do a home improvement project? Well, here's what you do. Go to prosper.com, fill out an easy online application, and you just give them a few details. You'll see a rate just like that. These are low fixed rates. They're unsecured personal loans. You do not need collateral. Multi-year terms are available. Prosper, it's Silicon Valley answer to the personal loan. Peer-to-peer lending, it's called, and I think it's just a great idea. No outrageous fees, no rising interest rates, and you don't have to put on your pants. You don't have to go to bank at all. Prosper.com/twit. Check that rate. It will not affect your credit score to check the rate, by the way. Prosper.com/twit. For a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit viewers a $50 prepaid card from Visa when you get a loan. That's nice. You get the loan and the $50 Visa card. Go to prosper.com/twit. Imagine up to $35,000 in just 3 days and a $50 Visa prepaid card. Prosper.com/twit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the number. 888-827-5536. Yes, 888 is a toll-free number. That means it'll cost you nothing in the U.S. and Canada. And if you use Skype to call me, it costs you nothing anywhere in the world. 8888-ASK-LEO. Back to the phones we go. And Jeremy in T.O., Thousand Oaks. Hello, Jeremy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. I am an elementary school principal, and we are rolling out a one-to-one model with our third-grade students this year.
How exciting!
Yeah, it's very exciting.
And thank you, by the way, for being an elementary school principal. That is a very important job.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate you doing it.
Wonderful job.
Yeah.
Thank you. So, you know, we've done a lot of research, and we have a curriculum to have the kids be safe and responsible digital citizens.
What are you giving them? What computer?
We are using Acer Troublemate laptops.
Okay. Windows?
Linux.
Linux?
Yes.
Wow. So these are going to be highly customized for elementary school students, I presume.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's see. So there's some service provider that offers this, obviously.
Yeah. So, yes, they have an image that, you know, we've customized.
Fantastic.
For our kiddos.
Yeah, because generally I recommend Chromebooks, which is also Linux, running the Chrome OS. They're cheap but safe, and I think this is good.
Yeah, the Chromebooks were a second contender for us. There were just some specific applications
that
we wanted
to
have.
No, I think
computers use as well.
This is even better.
All right.
Yeah.
But what we're looking for, and I don't know if it exists, is a program or website or a resource that will teach the kids just basic computer literacy that isn't necessarily platform specific. We are using Google Apps for Education, so they'll be using Google Docs and things like that.
Yeah.
We're wondering if there's something that would be appropriate for this age. You know, just
basic third graders.
Yeah, so nine-year-olds.
I do not know of anything, but maybe somebody in the chat room listening does. That's a great question. I mean, I think even at that age, they're going to just go, boom, yeah, no problem. But there will be a few kids. You know who you really need it for? The parents.
We do.
Because the parents are going to go, what?
Well, what we're finding is with the third graders, they have a lot of aptitude with tablets. But when it comes to file management and saving and save as and those sorts of things, they're not as adept as where we would like them to be.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And frankly, most adults aren't either. Every time I use somebody else's computer, I note, for instance, they never close apps. Because on a smartphone, a mobile device, you don't close apps, but on computers you do, but they don't. So they have 100 apps open. They never save to anywhere but the desktop. So they have a million little tiny icons on their desktop.
Exactly.
This is normal. I remember I did this for my ex-wife. I closed all her apps. She said, "What's that?" I said, "What do you mean, what's that?" She said, "What is that?" I said, "That's your desktop." "I've never seen that." "No, because you never close your apps." So the kids are not alone. And frankly, I think the future probably is that they won't need to know much about file management, that this will all be handled for them. So mm-hmm. you're teaching them kind of an older arcane topic.
Got it.
That we as old timers remember. I remember file save as. But on a mobile device, that doesn't make any sense. And most of the devices we use, including desktop computers, will be that way. Mostly that's because resources are kind of so unlimited now that you don't have to worry about running out of RAM or running out of CPU. So you can keep stuff running. And file systems are confusing inherently. So people don't do well with them. Plus, there's a security issue with file systems. And one of the reasons mobile devices kind of isolate the file system and don't really show it is because it's a security issue. So, but now, of course, you've got Linux laptops for your kids, so they do need to know how to do this. But I fear that you're teaching them something that they won't really be using in 10 years. Right?
Okay.
You think we'll have Save As in 10 years?
I hope not.
Apple's already and Microsoft already kind of eliminated it from their apps.
Right.
So
then we won't spin our wheels with that then.
Well, you need to teach them enough to be able to do what they need to do. I don't know of anything for 9-year-olds that say, here's how you save a file.
Okay.
Maybe somebody in the chat room does. The lynda.com has some basic stuff, but I don't know if it's appropriate for third graders. We'll keep listening. We'll look. Lifehack.org, thanks to Side of Fries in our chat room, has 10 Linux resources for kids. Lifehack.org. So you might look there. Yeah, that's what you want. You want a very simple thing. Here's one. E-learningforkids.org. E-learningforkids.org. Thank you, Simply Charlie, in our chat room. So these are some things that... But, my experience with kids is they don't have the fears we do of computers, and they just kind of jump right in.
Right, right.
But there will be a couple of kids that will go, I don't know what to do.
And then, yeah, we'll hold their hands.
How are your teachers with this? Are they pretty comfortable with it?
They are, yes. They've been great and very brave, and it's not easy to take risks and do something new. But, yeah, they're charging forward, and we front-loaded them with lots of professional development. And for us, obviously, the key is making sure that we don't lose sight that students' learning is the primary focus of all this, not just giving them a flashy computer.
But see, that's great. And this is the failing, I think, in a lot of one-to-one programs. One-to-one, by the way, folks, means one computer per child. And the problem that a lot of companies will say, hey, here's all the computers, here's all the equipment, here's all the software, and then no training at all for the teachers. And they're thrown in the deep end, and they don't know what to do. And so I'm really glad that your school district is focusing on both sides of that, because it's really important that the teachers are the ones who are going to be working with the kids.
That's right.
They need to.
Yeah, so are we.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, that's exciting, Jeremy. Is this a public school in Thousand Oaks?
It's public school, yes.
Wow, that's great. I think this is really an interesting way to go. I serve on the board of a high school that has a one-to-one program, and it's there's all sorts of fascinating challenges. But it's clearly something we need to teach our kids.
Exactly. Yeah, what I told the parents was they wouldn't tolerate us not teaching their kids fractions, and they shouldn't tolerate us not teaching their kids to use technology.
Imagine a kid getting out of high school or college and not knowing how to use a computer. Is that person going to be able to get a job?
That's right.
I don't know. I don't know. Hey, thank you for the job you do and for and doing this. This sounds like now school's already started, right?
Yes.
How is it working out so far? Is this the first year you've done it?
It's the first year. So we're still in the infant stages. The laptops are still coming in. So we expect a full launch in late October.
I bet everybody's very excited and nervous.
It is. All of the above.
Yeah. That's great. Well, stay in touch. Let me know how it works out.
I will. Thanks so much.
All right. Take care, Jeremy. Isn't that exciting? I think that's great. Real challenge, though. You know, I get asked a lot, how old should a kid be before they get introduced to technology? And that answer has changed a little bit with the advent of tablets. A two-year-old can use an iPad, and many do, or iPhone, or similar device. But I think the actual, you know, a laptop computer with a keyboard, that's something a kid's going to need when they start doing reports, when they start doing research. I guess schools still have libraries. I'm not sure why. Because most people don't need the library anymore, do you? Your library is the internet. So instead of teaching kids how to go down the hall to the library and use a card catalog, what grade does that start? Fourth, fifth? I think you need to teach them how to use the internet for research, how to write a paper. So fourth grade, fifth grade, something like that is, I think, when a kid needs to probably have access to a computer. It doesn't have to be his own. In fact, probably shouldn't be. And if you do have a computer in the house, keep it in a public area so you can kind of look over their shoulder, keep an eye on what they're doing. But they do need to be exposed to this. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. Let's talk high tech. Leo Laporte. I am the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Justin Bakersfield, Leo Laporte here. Hi, Justin.
How you doing, sir?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing all right. I got a question for you. I bought my mother a Dell laptop about 10 years ago. That was back in the XP days, and she's looking to upgrade. And I was looking to get her a new laptop, but I've been a Mac guy for a long time. So, I mean, I'm not too sure. What are the recommended brands and as far as specs for running Windows?
You like your mother, right?
Oh, I love my mother.
You're going to give her Windows, really?
She doesn't want a Mac. I tried my heart.
I would only give Windows to somebody I really don't like, to be honest with you. But okay.
Well, here's the thing. She's got a
What does she do on her computer?
Basic web browser. She does Facebook. She does a lot of Word documents and stuff like that.
Oh, so does she use it for work or just for fun?
She mostly for fun, but sometimes she's a teacher's assistant, so she does a lot of grading and
all right. So she may have to have Windows because there's software she uses.
She does a lot of. She uses Office a lot.
Yeah, well, Office is on the Mac. You know that, right?
Yeah,
and frankly, Office 365 is on everything because it's a web-based solution.
Yeah, and another thing is price. I was hopefully looking around $600.
Yeah, well, now you are talking Windows.
Yeah.
Windows or, in fact, what I would, you know, for most people, what I would suggest is either a tablet, like an iPad, or a Chromebook, because...
She has a tablet. I bought her an iPad.
Nice boy.
She uses it, but she yeah. I just think she's very old school. Uses it, but I think she goes to that familiarness.
Yeah, and that's why people buy Windows. You know, it's one of the it's a more of a knee jerk automatic purchase than a thoughtful one. It's overly complex for what most people do, and that's why I asked, what does she do? If you need Windows, fine, but most people who use Windows should have an IT department at their beck and call.
And since
you're a Mac user, you're not it.
Yeah.
You may not even want to be it, even if you were a Windows user. You know, you want to give her something she can use and not have to call somebody about. All right, we're gonna accept it. She's gonna have Windows. There are lots of good choices at $600. I would look at the brand names. I'd look at our Dell, Lenovo. They bought the IBM ThinkPad line. They make really nice professional grade laptops. You're on the lower end, which means you're going to get a consumer grade laptop. I'm not as crazy about those, frankly. Since you're getting her Windows 8.1, it would be nice to get her a touch screen. On the other hand, the good news is Windows 9 is coming out very soon, in about 4 months, and that will be less touch-centric. It'll be more like the older versions of Windows. So she could probably get away with a non-touch device. I'd also look at Acer makes low-cost, but fairly good low-cost stuff. Probably okay. Dell would be your best bet. It's uninspiring, but solid.
Now, she has a roommate who's got an Asus, and she was asking me questions.
Very nice. I like Asus a lot. Hey, there's one more thing. Actually, this Microsoft Surface Pro, little more when you add a keyboard, but it's right in there. That's a very nice, and it's a tablet / laptop.
Okay.
So that's another one, and that's from Microsoft itself, and a lot. That's one selling quite well now. People really like that.
Okay. Now, as far as specs like RAM and processor speed, as far as what's
well, you're going to be limited by the price. So if you can get her a core, an i5 or an i3, I would, but you may not be able to at that price. You might be getting a Celeron or a Pentium.
Okay.
They're okay. I mean, she's not doing anything super demanding, so that's fine. 4 gigs of RAM, again, it's the low end, but it's not. She's not doing anything super demanding. Hard drive, if you can afford an SSD, a solid-state drive, in a decent capacity, like 128 or 256 gigs, I would. It makes it so much faster. That's more important than the processor, frankly. And then, as I said, it's nice to get a touch screen. It's nice to get a higher res screen if you can. But again, these are all going to probably take you out of your price range.
Okay. All right. And within that price range, it's something that she could have for like the next 5 years or so, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, as far as you said, Windows 9. Do you know if that's going to, like, when that comes out, is it going to cost money to upgrade? Or
we don't know. There are rumors it'll be free, but I don't think it'll be super expensive. Microsoft's been pretty good about bringing the price down, and I think Windows 9 is going to be to Windows 8.1 what Windows 7 was to Vista. Not much different, but a polishing that makes people hated Vista. People hate Windows 8 even more. And Microsoft knows this, and they're going to refine it and solve some of those things that people just don't like about Windows 8.
Okay.
But it won't. I don't think it'll be substantially different under the hood.
Now, another question was, what do you think about buying refurbished?
If you buy refurbished from the original manufacturer, in other words, Dell's outlet, Apple's outlet, Lenovo's outlet, that's fine. Do not buy from a third party.
Okay.
That's not refurbished. That's used. Companies now in the U.S. have to sell anything that's been opened as they can't sell it as new. So typically what these late model refurbished things from the manufacturer, they just something somebody bought and returned. Dell has a very good outlet, and I highly recommend it.
Okay. Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
Regarding the new iPhone, what do you think as far as the camera, the bubble on the camera?
No, I don't know why anybody's making any deal about that at all. It's a it's a millimeter raised. You're going to put it in a case anyway, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
You won't, then it doesn't matter.
Oh, no, yeah,
It's funny that Apple's actually editing out of their, you know, when Apple takes a side picture of it, it's not visible, and I think that they must be Photoshopping it out. So they're obviously sensitive about it. I don't know why they're sensitive. It's just, it's not that big a deal. It's a little tiny lip. You can barely see it. In fact, I can hardly see it here. So don't worry about that. It's a really great camera.
Yeah, definitely. Well, all right, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Yeah, they had to put this raised lip on because of the camera size itself. This is the problem Apple's starting to face. They want these things to be thinner and thinner and thinner, but there's only so thin you can get for the camera. In fact, you'll notice a number of higher-end camera phones, like the Lumia 1020 from Microsoft, their Windows phone, has a bump. There's a whole ridged bump there, not just around the camera, but that whole end. And that's so that they can put more stuff in there. I don't think that this raised lip is a problem. That doesn't bother me anyway. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, you'd like to talk high tech, you'd like to yell at me, that's fine too. Our website, techguylabs.com. If you yell at me, I might yell back. That's all. I got to warn you. TechGuyLabs.com. You can go there to get all the questions, all the answers for every show, audio and video after the fact, too. And your comments appreciated there, too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt's here. He's the photo guy. Joins us every week to talk about digital photography, cameras, and the like. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I am doing wonderful.
What is our topic du jour?
Well, the topic du jour, we started this a couple of weeks ago, talking about gear, talking about equipment. This time I want to talk a bit more about some of the gear that you could use to protect your camera.
Ah.
Because that's a question that I get a lot. So I thought we'll talk a bit. And I mean, we have to distinguish between storage of your camera, like when you're at home, and protection on the road. And obviously the function of that is to protect the camera from dings or from theft, and their entire strap and back systems that kind of have integrated steel meshes and things to protect from theft. That's not really the thing I want to talk about, just mentioning it here. I want to talk about when you're on the road. And there are several different ways that people tend to want to protect their cameras. One is what we call the ready bag.
Yeah.
You have a ready bag for your camera.
What is a ready bag?
Well, there are lots of different types, and typically they're minimal in size. The camera just fits in there, which is in itself a bit of a problem because eventually it'll be too small for your camera because you tend to add things to your camera or get a bigger lens, for example, and then doesn't really fit anymore. So if you get one, make sure to plan a bit for the future there. I think I have, in all, I have like 5, 6, 7 different camera bags around because I made the mistake too often to buy them too small. The one word of caution is, and you know me, I've always have to have access to my camera right away. They kind of tend to stand between you and your photos sometimes. You know, they are, sometimes I hear them referred to as the never quite ready bag because you're starting to fiddle and open the strap and thing.
I have a bag I really like. I'm trying to remember who makes it.
It's like a
Like a bicycle messenger bag, but then it's designed in such a way that if you slide it around, your camera's right on the top there, and you can just pull it right out and use it, and then you can sling it back. So it's a little bigger than a ready bag. It's still not a full-size camera bag. You know, it doesn't hold all your lenses. You have to pick a couple of lenses and a body. But it's a really nice way, and it really gets out of the way.
Well, if it's out of the way, if it's in your bag, but then it takes time to sling it forward.
Oh,
so,
no, I'm fast.
just keep that in mind. If you have a situation that's gonna be that you think might be interesting from a photography point of view, get the camera out
low
before
pro.
It actually happens.
It's a low pro, I think. Yeah.
It's a low pro sling something.
Yeah.
Yep. Next thing to protect your camera is a lens cap, obviously. Now I do, I lose mine all the time because, you know, I put it in pocket and then I forget to put it back on and then I end up with my camera, the lenses in the camera bag, not having the lens caps on there anymore. But I kind of still protect the lenses by having a lens hood on. So that's a bit of a help. Now there are little gadgets that help you not to lose lens caps, and one of them is you've seen those before, like little strings that have an adhesive on both sides, and one side goes on the lens cap, the other goes on the camera, and then you have the lens cap kind of dangle off the lens. I don't really like that because it kind of is a bit of a distraction. There are other little gadgets that are clips that you put on a camera strap, and then you just clip the lens cap in there. So if you have a lens cap, if you tend to lose them, that's the kind of thing I would typically do.
I'm always feel like I'm going to lose my lens cap. You know, on point-and-shoot cameras, they usually do have a little string. But it's the pros don't want that. I don't know why.
It looks very tourist, you know. That's a thing.
pros don't use lens caps.
No, that's not true. They do, but I tend to not have a lens cap on. Again, one of the things that is potentially between me and the picture. So,
well, that's what I do. I take it off at the beginning of the shoot or the walk or whatever. Put it in my pocket, and I don't put it back on till the end. And that way, I don't lose it.
I can have a lens cap off for an entire day, and then the other day, it's put back on.
I mean, a little dust or what? It's not going to hurt it.
Yeah. The next thing to protect your camera, obviously, again in the lens area, are protective filters. We have in the past talked about them at length. I'm not a fan of them because they have a potential to introduce some artifacts in your pictures when you shoot into light sources like lens flare and things that might not be desirable. Personally, I'm not a fan, but they are. If you get one that's multi-coated, those tend to be quite a bit more expensive than the real cheap ones. So we're not talking about $20. We're more talking about $100 or more for a good protective filter for your lens. That's kind of the area that I would go into. Display protection on your camera. Do you have a protector on your camera's display?
No, really?
If you buy a Nikon camera, Nikon cameras have them kind of built into the camera almost. They are clipped on and they're on there all the time. They're adhesives that you put on that stick on the screen. Same as with mobile phones. Again, not much of a fan of those because they tend to kill the contrast on the preview image if you look at them. And with the newer cameras sporting touch screens, a lot of them do now, it kind of changes that feeling of the touch. And then if you do like swipe gestures and things, they tend to feel more sticky than the actual display to me.
One of our visitors in the studio, what's your name again?
Peter
is here, and he just handed me this. He has it from Optech. It's called a rain sleeve, and it's like a little disposable raincoat for your camera and your hand. And you put there's two of them in here, and you've put so if it's raining suddenly, you can just put your camera in the rain sleeve and your hand in the rain sleeve. You can still take pictures.
That is a very good thing if you go out. Well, and I recommend going out and shooting in the rain. So this kind of a protection for your camera is a good idea. You know what I tend to use?
A baggie.
I'm doing this. I'm doing this on the cheap. Next time you're in a hotel, take the shower cap with you. I'm not kidding.
That's a good idea.
You can wrap that around the camera from behind so the lens sticks out in the front. And then you can actually handle the camera through this thin plastic foil and it'll protect the camera. A shower cap from your next hotel stay.
Brilliant.
Take it with you. You'll thank me. It's not going to take up any space in your camera bag. And you'll thank me next time you can go out in the rain and shoot and bring home pictures that no one else is bringing home.
As we all know, people like me get into photography purely for the gear. So anything I can buy, any new device or gadget or gee-jaw I can buy and hang off my camera bag, I'm happy to have it. Peter's now going to demonstrate the pouch. Wow. That's, interesting.
Well, the one thing I clearly recommend against is camera armor. That's rubber protection that you put on your camera that has like little openings to reach the different buttons, and you can then.
So it's like an underwater case for.
No. It's not waterproof or anything. It just helps you against banging the camera against something.
Pro photographers are the hardest on their cameras I have ever seen. I mean, they bang their camera up.
A problem, and then I really see a problem there because I've seen photographers not getting lots of shots because they ended up trying to fiddle with the camera but couldn't reach certain knobs and things. And it was hard to watch because
does OtterBox make a camera case? They make great cases for phones.
I don't know. Chris Marquardt,
he does workshops. He's a great photographer, does a podcast on photography. You can find it all at discoverlightroom.com. Thank you. So good to talk to you, Chris. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. The website is techguylabs.com. I should have mentioned while we were talking to Chris Marquardt, we each month we do a kind of a little photo assignment, not a competition by any means. An assignment, it just means it's an opportunity and a challenge for you to go out and take some pictures. And you don't have to have a fancy camera. You can use your smartphone or whatever. But what we ask is, and we're in the middle of an assignment right now, you take a picture illustrating the word, the concept, the idea, whatever it means to you when I say layers. What does that mean to you? Well, take a picture, layers, and then what you're going to do is you're going to upload it to our tech guy group on Flickr. Tag it with the word layers, too, so we know. Renee Silverman, our moderator, will, if you're not already a member, welcome you to the group. And in fact, if you go to the, if you're not a member of Flickr, you should be. It's free. It's a Yahoo site. It can give you a terabyte of storage. You can upload your photos. FLICKR.com. Join Flickr if you're not already a member, and then join the Tech Guy group. Also free. Renee will welcome you. The rules and everything for the, it's not a contest, so there really aren't rules. The assignment is all there. And just what does layers say to you? What could that be? Evan, Long Island, New York. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Evan.
Yes, hi, Leo. I've been listening to you for about 15 years.
Yikes! That's great. Thank you. I am grateful. That's about as long as I've been doing it.
I listen to a lot of audiobooks.
Yeah, me too.
And I use iTunes for it.
Yeah.
And the experience is driving me crazy.
Why is that?
Because I buy a book and some books hold your place when you close the app, some don't, yeah. And it's driving me nuts.
So you can make them all do that. Yeah, I'll explain how you do that. So, of course, when you're listening to a song, you usually don't want to begin the song in the middle. If you listen to half the song, you want to start over when you listen to a song. So that's the normal default behavior of iTunes and most music players. You pick a song, even if you've been listening to it, you start over. But that's because a song's 3.5 minutes. A book could be 30 hours. You certainly don't want to start over at the beginning every time you start playing the book. And that's true of podcasts, too. And so iTunes gives you a way in the metadata of the book to indicate that that is a special kind of book that you, a special kind of audio thing that you want to listen to differently. And the way you do that is by selecting the genre audiobook in the info. So when you buy an audiobook and you download it, or buy anything like that that's long that you want to don't always want to begin in the middle of, you need to indicate to iTunes, hey, this isn't a song. It's an audiobook. Now, I shouldn't say genre because it's not specifically the genre. There is a genre, you know, rock and roll, classics, and there's an audiobook genre. But in fact, what you're going to go is into the options tab on iTunes. And where it says media kind, you're going to select audiobook. Podcasts, similarly, will do the same thing. That's a signal to iTunes, hey, when you play this one back, please don't rewind. Be kind, don't rewind. That's simple. I usually buy my audiobooks from audible.com, and they're already, you know, indicated that way, so I don't ever have to worry about this. But anytime you download something really long that you don't want to begin again at the beginning, you can just do that in the settings. Just click the item in iTunes, get info, and go to the options tab and select the media kind audiobook. Ed in Charlotte, North Carolina. Leo Laporte. Oh, hello, Ed. Leo Laporte. Whoa, let me tell you, Ed is noisy. So could you fix that somehow there, Heather? And we'll get to Ed in a second. He wants to know how, what, well, this is a big question right now. Should he buy a phone subsidized or unsubsidized? The pros and cons. Is Ed ready now, you think? Let's see what's going on with the, I'll try him again.
Yeah, hello.
Hey, good to talk to you, Ed. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What can I do for you?
Well, my question is about the new iPhone. I have an opportunity to go ahead and upgrade to the new iPhone 6 or 6 Plus. But again, my contract hasn't ended yet. Being an eight, since I'm with AT&T, I can go and purchase a new iPhone unsubsidized.
Right.
I want to know, what are the benefits, if there is any, to purchase an unsubsidized phone?
Well, understand that the phone companies realize these phones are ridiculous. A top-of-the-line iPhone 6 Plus is $949. That's a lot of money. The cheapest iPhone, I think, is $600 or $700. So they're very expensive. So, and this, by the way, is unique to the U.S. and Canada and many other places of the world. They don't do subsidized. The way they do it is they say, well, we'll let you buy this phone for starting at $200, but you have to agree to 2 years of service with us. And if you decide not to, we're going to charge you an early termination fee. You know all this. The thing about it is, it subsidized, yes, but really you're paying for it. They're building that into the cost of your service, of course. Not explicitly. They don't raise the cost, but they know they're making the money back. So most people do this. The problem is you can only do it every couple of years in most cases. So if you want to get a new phone, you're kind of out of luck. All the carriers now have special plans for people like me who want to buy a new phone every year or even more often. But you'll pay; it costs you more to do that than just paying outright. So if you pay outright, you're subsidizing it yourself. It's the same phone. You're not going to extend your service. There are some cases where you want to do that. If, for instance, if you're a Verizon customer and you have unlimited data, the only way to keep the unlimited data is to pay the full price for the phone, even if you're due an upgrade. That's what Verizon does to encourage you not to have unlimited data. They'd love to get you off that plan. But so you're AT&T. If you can't upgrade, sometimes they'll give you a little bit of a discount because you've been a member for a year or whatever. But if you can't upgrade, you're just gonna pay the full price. And these are very expensive devices. They're more expensive than a laptop computer in many cases.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, can I give a shout out to a couple of podcasts I listen to?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a podcaster myself. I support podcasts. What do you like?
Well, I'm in technology. I just came back from a meetup that was hosted by Surface Geeks Podcast and Home Server Show podcast by Dave McCabe. He hosted that, and it was also co-sponsored by the Home Tech Podcast as well. It was over there in Fisher, Indiana. It's a really good time.
Surface Tech Podcast. I guess that's all about the Microsoft Surface.
Mm-hmm.
And Home Tech
Show.
And which? Yeah, what's the third show? Old Server Show. Old Server Show. Did you say that?
The Home Server.
Oh, it would have been more fun if it was Old Server. All right. Home Server Show, Surface Tech, and Home Tech. Those are the three.
Yep, and the Surface Geeks.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Great to talk to you, Ed. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
I have time maybe to at least start a call. Caleb in Newfoundland, New Jersey. Oh, it's Caleb. Hi, Caleb.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
How do you get through all the time? You have some magic touch.
Not really.
It's hard to get through, you know. Nobody told you that, I guess. That's where kids have an advantage. They don't know what they can't do. Hang on, Caleb. We're going to take a break for the top of the hour news. We'll be right back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers and the internet and home theater, digital photography. iPhones, sure, smartphones. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada. You give me a ring, we'll talk high tech. That's what Caleb did from beautiful Newfoundland, New Jersey. Hi, Caleb.
Hey, Leo, how are you?
What's up?
Nothing much. I guess a lucky call.
Yeah, I don't know how you get through all the time, but I'm glad you do. What can I do for you?
It's related to photography, but it's actually about editing and hardware.
Okay.
Here we go. I'm thinking, because, like, you ever had, like, a moment where, like, you log into your computer or something, like, this seems like something's different, but, like, you don't know what it is?
What's your question, Caleb?
I'm thinking about getting, or, like, trying to save enough money to get my own, MacBook Air or Pro for editing.
Walter in Huntington, West Virginia. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Walter.
Hi, Leo. since iOS 8 came up, I can no longer use assistive touch. And what I, and I want
what
I want to
really
do is,
you can't
I you all the problem with it is that if you have two fingers on the screen at the same time, it will not respond most of the time.
That's too bad. I mean, one of the things the iPhone did so well is accessibility.
Yes. Well, I want to move a picture to the top of the screen.
Yeah.
And hold it there and take a screenshot. Well, accessibility worked just fine. And trying to press the two buttons at the same time and take a screenshot while holding the picture to the top, that's difficult. So, do you have any suggestions? Any editor that might allow me to do that? Or any other suggestions?
Do you think they disabled that, or is it somehow something's changed?
Well, they definitely changed it because I spoke to their senior advisor yesterday, and she tried it on iOS 7.
And she said, it works here, and it doesn't work there. They changed it.
Yeah, right, exactly, right. So it makes me really angry because I do a lot of moving to the top and taking screenshots.
So describe the process again. You want to...
Okay, well, I have a photo in the middle of the screen.
Okay.
And it's got a black space above it.
And you don't want that.
I don't want that. And I can't use cropping because that enlarges the picture and makes it less clear and doesn't bring it to the top of the screen anyway.
And you're going to do a screenshot and then email it or...
No, just keep it.
So you're just trying to trim off this stuff in the phone.
Right, 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 yeah. And on the iPad, actually, yeah. And I can't do it now with assistive touch.
You got me. I don't know. I mean, the way Apple works, your camera roll pictures are accessible to other apps. You know what? I would try Snapseed.
Snapseed, okay.
Free. It's a Google product. They bought a company called Nix Software. It's a really good photo editor. It does have cropping. I can't promise this will work. This may be a system-wide problem. Or it may be specific to that, to the iPhone camera app or gallery app. And by using Snapseed, you can get around it. Snapseed is a great photo editor. It does a good job cropping, but a lot of other stuff.
Well, thank you.
All right. Hey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Catherine, Alta Loma, California. Hi, Catherine. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Oh, hello, Leo. Thanks for talking to me.
Well, it's always good
to talk to you. I've listened to you for years.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
I'm 80 years old, and I've had Verizon Telephone Company since 1977, and recently I allowed myself to be lured to Southern California Telephone and Energy Company to save money on my phone bill. Well, September 8th, the change was made, and that same day, the light for DSL on my modem went out.
Well, that's right, because your DSL service is provided by that other company, which has now been cut off.
Except that Southern California on their flyer says at the bottom bullet point says Verizon will still own and maintain the phone lines, and Southern California telephone company would simply take over the billing and service.
Yeah.
So I talked to...
Well, wait a minute. Stop. Stop right there. That's everything you need to know. The copper is owned by Verizon. That's because they put it in. There's nothing they can do about it.
Right.
When you switched service, you turned off all your Verizon services.
Uh-huh.
You're still using their hardware, but not their services.
Yeah.
You're using Southern California Telephone and Energy.
Yeah.
That means you no longer have DSL from Verizon. You switched it off.
Right.
If you want DSL, I don't know if Southern California Telephone and Energy offers DSL.
They do, but
then you'll have to contract with them.
Allow me to use Earthlink. I would have to discontinue that and use Southern California's DSL.
That's right.
They don't allow me, for instance, to get DSL Extreme.
That's right. So, that's what you agreed to do.
Well, I didn't know that.
I know, because they don't tell you that, because they don't want you to know that.
So I guess I'll just go back to Verizon then.
That's what I would do.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's a very highfalutin name, Southern California Telephone and Energy. It makes you makes it feel like it's maybe a public utility. It's not.
Yes,
it's
and
not.
They've been there. They're in Temecula, I guess.
Yeah,
they say at the bottom of their brochure that Verizon still owns and maintains the
as always, because the company that put the line in owns it. But that doesn't mean you get any services from Verizon.
Except they maintain the line.
Well, that means if the telephone pole falls down, they're responsible for putting it back
yes.
up. But you've discontinued your Verizon services.
Yeah.
That includes DSL.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. Don't confuse the fact that Verizon owns the line with Verizon giving you anything. What would be a good example? It's as if, the city of Temecula owns the pipes for your water system, but the water comes from the Howard Hughes Energy and Water Company. And they're responsible for the water, not the city. The city just owns the pipes. Verizon just owns the telephone lines, the pole out front, the box on the side of your house. And that's all they do. That's all they don't have to worry anymore about your phone service or your internet service. That comes from the highfalutin sound in Southern California telephone and energy. It's, by the way, the Wolf of Wall Street, right? What did he name his company? His company was selling junk stocks, right? It was, essentially a ripoff. But of course, he didn't name the company the Junk Stock Fund. He gave it some highfalutin name. I always get suspicious when I hear a highfalutin name, like the Southern California Telephone and Energy Company.
Stratton-Oakmont.
Stratton-Oakmont. Doesn't that sound... That's high class.
With a big lion on
it. Yes, they had the lion. How could he be a ripoff? What a name. I'm not saying that Southern California Telephone and Energy is a ripoff. I just wonder what the energy part is. I think they just do phone service. I think they just threw the energy in there. they want to sound, it's pretty clear, they want to sound like a public utility. They're just a company, as there are a lot of them, that sells phone service. And they don't even own the lines. Verizon owns the lines. Maybe they're just very energetic. That's probably it. So I'm sorry, Catherine, that they weren't clear. And unfortunately, a lot of these companies are like that. And I'll tell you what. I tell my mom the same thing because she gets the same calls. Stick with what you know. Stick with your phone company. Maybe it's a little more expensive. There's a reason. And you want to have the company that owns the line. It's nice to have the company that owns the physical line also providing you with a phone service. Those seem like those should go together. I'd love to know more about SCT&E. I don't know a thing about them. Oh, wait a minute. They do energy. They have liquid natural gas as well. So they are an energy company. I take it back. I'm sorry that happened to you, Catherine, but the good news is you could switch back to Verizon. In fact, I would. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo, on with the show. David in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, David.
Hey, how's it going, Mr. Laporte?
It's going great. How are you?
Hey, not too bad. I am a general contractor.
Okay.
And I am getting ready to go in and get a new phone. And I was wondering what your advice would be where I could eliminate my iPad, eliminate possibly my laptop. Where I can just have one device to carry around.
Well, your timing is very good, my friend, because the new Apple iPhone 6 Plus at 5.5 inches is about as big. It's like a mini iPad. It is the same as an iPad in the sense that it runs all the same programs. There are a few iPad-only programs, but for the most part, you're going to find the same programs on any iPhone. And with a screen that big, I think in many cases, people will eliminate the iPad and just go with the iPhone. That's, I think, one of the things that's driven Apple and many other companies to make larger screen phones. Your smartphone really is your primary computer increasingly, right?
Yes, it is. So you would go with the new iPhone over the Note 3?
Well, the Note 3 is exactly the same size as the new iPhone. The Note 4 is a little bigger. There are 6-inch phones like the Nokia Lumia 1520. They're about as big as you can get. I mean, you can get a 7- or 8-inch tablet and put phone software on it. But I think that gets unwieldy. So, yeah. And since you said you have an iPad and you're using your iPad, I think, frankly, this would be a really good choice, the 5.5-inch iPhone. You should probably just go to an Apple store or your phone company store and look at it. Because do you use it for your contracting work? Do you use it for estimates, things like that?
Well, the phone I have now is the S4, and
right.
I use it for everything. I use it to do invoices, estimates, my yards, billing, every single thing with my business is through that.
And is any of that Android specific?
Not. I can't say for sure. I am not the most technical person in the world.
So since you're already using a Galaxy phone, you might want to look at the Note 4 because it's a little bigger, and it will be. And it, by the way, the transition's very easy. You basically sign into your Google account on the Note 4, and all of your apps will transfer over, and you're good to go. So the biggest change is it'll be a slightly bigger phone, and that's what you want. You want a bigger screen.
All right, I appreciate it.
I think the Note 4 is the right choice for you. Just coming out right now, and since you're already using an S4, this is it. Everything you need. I was thrown a little bit when you mentioned the iPad. I thought maybe you use the iPad for your work. But if you're using the S4, get a Note. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Is it Avun? Avon? How do you pronounce your name, sir?
My name is Avi.
Avi. Oh, it looked like there was an extra letter there. All right. Hi, Avi.
Hi.
I see. It says Avi in, and I thought it was Avin. Hi, Avi. Welcome.
It was a pleasure talking to you, sir.
Thanks for calling.
Quick question, maybe it's a dumb question, but I have been a Google user and an Android user all my life up till now, and never owned an Apple product. But with the iPhone 6, I'm trying to look into some possibilities of using that and have ordered one. Just want to know what will be the hurdles or things hard to use if I go from Android to Apple.
You know, I feel very fortunate because I, as part of my job, I use every phone. In fact, I buy every phone. I have an account with every carrier. And it's part of what I need to do is understand how these all work. So just like I use Windows and Mac and Linux, I use iPhone and Android and Windows Phone. And you know, one thing I'll say right up front, they're all great. The market has become mature enough now. What people want to do with a smartphone is well enough understood now. They're all great, but they're great in different ways. So just as if you were moving from Windows to Mac or Mac to Windows, you're going to be in a little bit of a unknown world, a little foreign-feeling world at first, because iPhone does do some things differently. In particular, you'll notice, for instance, no widgets. I don't know if you used widgets on your phone, but the iPhone interface is just icons, a grid of icons. You may say you'll feel fairly comfortable with the notification system because, let's face it, Apple copied Android there. I think the Android system is a little bit more flexible. And then there's just little weird things that don't make any difference but might be a little disorienting. For instance, on Android, when you want to get to settings, you pull down the notifications shade and you tap the gear, and there's your settings. On iPhone, settings is an application that you need to run, and within that, all the settings are. Now, that's not... Neither one is better, but it's different enough that it's going to take you a day or two to... Oh, that's what I switch back and forth. I just switch to the iPhone for the new ones for a little bit, probably not forever. And I have to remind myself, that's where the settings are. I think you'll like it. It'd be very interesting to get your experience, frankly.
Sure. My only concern is that since I have all my contacts and everything on Google...
Nothing to worry about there. The beauty of it is... Apple, when you're setting up, there's a mail and contacts setting. You go in there and you choose Google, and it will log into your Google account. It'll get your calendar, your contacts, your email, all your Google stuff will go in there. The one place that Google is a little bit of a second-class citizen is instead of using the Google Voice, now you'll be using Siri, right? Similar capabilities, but you'll have to get used to that. And Google Now, instead of being kind of part of the desktop, is now in an application. You'll have to get the Google app and use the cards there. Give me a sense of how you like it. I'd love to hear from you when you get it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Paul, Long Beach, California, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Hey,
I was
Paul.
Just wondering who you're recommending now to host websites.
Well, we have an advertiser called Squarespace, and I'd certainly look at that, but it depends a lot on what you want to do. So tell me a little bit about what you want to do. I mean, there's all kinds of web hosting services.
It's basically going to be very simplistic. I want to post a player that people can access of a famous site.
Well, there probably you don't want to pay anything, in which case I would look at Blogger from Google. That's blogspot.com or wordpress.com. Those are both free. They support themselves by putting ads on your site. Tumblr also from Yahoo, tumblr.com. All three of those are free and very popular and have a fairly large community that goes along with them. But they're relatively inflexible. You know, you don't have a whole lot of control over what you're doing, but I think they're very good. If you want to go to the next level up, where really it kind of depends what the content management system is, the software you're using. If you want to customize, you know, really highly customize it, control the site a little bit more, maybe if you want to do some e-commerce, perhaps tie in social media, stuff like that, Squarespace is a great choice. That's the next step up, and it's not free, it's paid. There, of course, you can go much, much richer and deeper. We use, for instance, for the Tech Guy Lab site, a content management system, open source content management system called Drupal. And that needs to be on a host that can support Drupal, and it goes on and on and on. But for just a simple free website, it sounds like that's all you need, Blogger, WordPress.com, and Tumblr. Just pick one. Any of them, they're all great. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, Mike in Orange County. What can I do for you, Mike?
Hi, Leo. Hey. I've got a question about a printer.
All right.
I have an HP, and I need to take it in to get some service, or maybe they'll give me a new one because it's under contract. But I understand that it has a memory, and if I take it in, is that memory, can somebody hack into it? Because there's social security numbers and that kind of stuff on there.
Boy, paranoia runs deep into your heart. It will creep. We learned from some hackers a couple of years ago that many, not all, but many printers have memory. And if you think about how a printer works, that makes sense because what generally happens is you don't want to sit there and wait. Remember in the early days of printers, you'd send a job to the printer and you'd just sit there and wait. And then you could use the computer after the printer was done. Well, obviously, we want to do better than that. So we do things called print spooling. Print spooling can be done from your computer. The computer continues to work and sends out a little bit at a time. But modern printers, because memory's gotten so cheap, modern printers have their own memory and their own spooler. So the computer can send the job to the printer and then go on with its life, continue to work, while the printer does the print job. So it has to have memory to store the page you sent it. The question and the thing that's not completely clear is how much memory does it have and how much does it store? I can almost assure you that it doesn't have enough memory to store more than, you know, 20 or 30 pages, whatever a big document would be. There's no reason for them to put more memory in. It just adds to the cost. So it doesn't remember everything you've ever printed. At worst, it remembers the last few things you printed. And even then, it seems now. And if you work in a repair shop and you repair printers, you can call me anonymously and tell me: do you ever look at that memory? Do you even have a way to do that? Do you have any interest in what's in there? My suspicion is no. I wouldn't worry about it. it's all theoretical. In most cases, I wouldn't think this memory would be non-volatile. It turns out it is in some cases. That means even if you unplug the printer, it will remember some of the last few things you printed. I just don't think this is something you should worry about. Just bring it in and get it fixed. Mark in Anaheim, California. It's amazing how paranoid we all are these days. Hi, Mark. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
Hi, Leo. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of real quick questions for you. My Vista machine basically died on me, and I had to go to Windows 8.1. And I understand that there's a little program for a couple of dollars, and it's called Start Is Back.
There's actually quite a few of these. But people who went to Windows 8 and then later 8.1 were a little shocked, in some cases perturbed, to learn that the start menu was gone. Instead, we have a start screen, those tiles. But enough people hate it that there are quite a few programs that can bring it back. There's Classic Shell. The ones I recommend come from a company called Stardock at stardock.com. It's $5. It's not free. Classic menu is free. A classic shell is free. But StarDock's, what is it called? StartX, I think is what it's called. It's $5. I think it works really, really well. It's, you know, I'm sorry, it's Start 8, isn't it? Start 8. It works really, really well. So you can get it from StarDock. I think the free programs work as well. Classic Shell is free. I don't know the one you mentioned, but... There's a lot of these, right?
Okay. But so they're legitimate, and they will take you back to basically kind of emulate Windows 7.
Yeah, some better than others. And the reason I'm willing to pay the $5 for StarDock's solutions is because they are a commercial company. They do make money on it. I feel they do somewhat of a better job than the freebies.
Okay, that's question number one. Question number two, I heard on the news, unless I was like having a nightmare, that Facebook, they have a mobile, a download Facebook
mobile app,
download.
Yeah.
And I heard that in the terms and conditions buried in there somewhere, that they're able to basically have access to your complete smartphone. And they can turn it on, they can turn it off, they can...
Yeah, let me explain a little bit about that. It isn't a nightmare, it's true. It's not something to worry about. So both Apple and Android require that developers request permission to do things on your smartphone. This is a smart thing to do. Apple doesn't publish that. They just look at it. But in the software, they're required to request things like access to your phone dialer or your text messaging, things like that. In Android, when you install an app, you'll see this actual list of the permissions that they require. And sometimes this scares people. For instance, when you install Facebook Messenger, it asks for permission to read and write text messages, make phone calls, lots of stuff. And I think people look at that and they go, oh my goodness. But that's because they don't understand why Messenger is asking for that information. In fact, you can use Messenger to make a phone call. So it has to ask that permission or it wouldn't have that functionality in the application. Does it mean that Messenger is going to make phone calls on its own? Well, it could, but it's not. Does it mean Messenger is going to send and read your text messages on its own? It could. It does have permission to do that, but it's not going to. Understand, when you install an application on your computer, we don't have these facilities. That application can do anything it wants without telling you, without asking for permission. It always has been. This is something new, and it's scaring the pants off people because it's explicit. But it's always been implicit on every program you've ever run. So don't worry. It's fine. And shame on the news organizations that use this to generate clicks because they're just scaring people unnecessarily. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 22 people are killed in the U.S. every year by cows. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. Last segment of the day. I want to say something about... because, you know, we seem to be all of a sudden very scared about an awful lot of stuff. And I think what happens is that the news media... and it's really gotten bad now that everybody's a journalist, everybody's got a blog, and everybody's in desperate competition to get you to read their page. So they call it clickbait, which is a headline designed to get you to click on it. And because of clickbait on the internet, you got clickbait on national television news. You got clickbait on local television news. You got clickbait everywhere you go. And what gets more attention than a dire warning of something horrible that Facebook or Google or the internet is about to do to you? So just think back before there were mobile phones. You install a program on your computer. That program can do anything it darn well wants, and it doesn't have to ask you permission. If it wants to use the internet to rack up charges, it could go out and buy shoes. It could do anything it wants, and it never asks for permissions because we never thought of that. We designed the mobile platform. Both Google and Apple and Microsoft thought, well, maybe we want to make these a little bit more secure, especially since they're always on. They have a phone connection. They have a text message. So we're going to be make developers be explicit about the kinds of things they want to do. Now, they're doing the same things. If you install Facebook or Facebook Messenger, Facebook allows you to make free calls via Skype. Facebook Messenger will actually dial somebody you're talking to if you want to make a phone call. In order to activate them, they send a text message to your phone to verify that that's your phone number. All of these things are things that are normal. But because of the way we've designed mobile phones, they have to explicitly ask for this kind of permission. Apple's decided, in its very Apple-y way, that the developer doesn't have to tell you. The developer has to tell Apple. And then Apple decides, okay, you can do that. And later, the iPhone will probably alert you if an application starts to do something. But you don't see the blanket list of things that an app can do. Android decided, well, we don't want to be responsible for that. So we're just going to say, when an app installs, before you download it, the app must divulge a complete and thorough list of all the things it wants to do. But the way these lists are designed, it doesn't say... you don't want them to be too granular. So if it can access the phone, then that's what the permission is. If it can access text messages, read and write text messages, that's what the permission is. It's not more detailed than that. It's normal. It's fine. It's how these programs work. If you didn't give them permission to do that, the program wouldn't do what you expect it to do. It's something that computer programs have historically always done without asking permission. It's only now that they have to ask permission, and that's a good thing, except... people use it for clickbait, to scare you, to get you to worry. Don't worry, relax. Either you trust technology or you don't. There's no halfway. Either you trust it or you don't. I started the show saying this, and I'll end the show saying this. In modern civilized world, we live in a web of trust. We have to trust everybody all the time. Trust them not to plow their car into you. Trust the plane not to fall out of the sky. Trust your computer not to do something malicious. We live in a world of trust. Don't live in a world of paranoia. And if you really don't trust it, don't just get off the internet. Move to the country, far away from people. And by the way, stay away from cows, because cows kill 22 people every single year in this country. Cows! I'm just saying, it's okay. You can relax. Your computer's not out to get you. I'm kind of to blame for this. I certainly, we talk about, Microsoft, somebody pretending to be from Microsoft calling you on the phone, taking over your computer. We talk about that a lot. And you hear on this show a lot of people who've had problems with malware. And certainly it's out there. I don't think you have to worry about Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Apple. They're not the enemy. Daniel, Pasadena, California. Leo Laporte. I'm sorry, not Daniel. Evan in San. You'll be next, Daniel. Evan in San Diego. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Evan.
Quick question for you. I got the iPhone 6 on Friday. I set up my Outlook account through the general settings, and that came up fine. On Outlook, I have several folders, and each of the folders is a number of emails. The folders showed up on the iPhone 6. The emails in the folders did not show up. Now, when I had the iPhone 5, the folders and the emails were there, no problem. When I updated to iOS 8, no problem. But as soon as I set up the iPhone 6 on Friday, the folders show up, but not the emails in the folders.
Well, obviously, that's not supposed to happen. You've waited a reasonable amount of time.
Right.
Yeah, because remember, it's starting from scratch. It's using Exchange to get the email. And, of course, that's a server-based system where all the email and all the folders, all the organization, that's all on the server and stays on the server, but gets duplicated to your phone. And it sounds like, the first thing it does is make folders, and then it will populate those folders with the email and the folders. It sounds like it either got stuck or it's not done. If it continues, I would say remove the account and add it again.
Well, here's the thing that's strange. I mean, I've done that. I've removed the account and installed it. Recently, within the last week or so, I put some emails in some of the folders, and they show up on the 6. But anything beyond that, You know, these emails aren't showing up.
So it's newer or older that's not showing up?
It's old ones that aren't showing up. If I get an email today
that's
and
right.
put it in one of the folders, it'll be there.
That's what it's supposed to do.
Okay.
Because it's not, they don't want to overwhelm your phone with every email message you ever got. So I suspect if you check, there may be an option to get the old email. But I think that that's probably something they don't want to do. That they want it from now forward. Do you see what I'm saying? To keep it from overwhelming the inbox. There may be in the settings. Right. I seem to remember there is in the settings that you can say how far back to go. And this may be something new that they do that's different. I don't know.
What I'm saying is it doesn't seem like it's syncing to me. The folders are there, but...
Well, it's syncing new email, though, right?
Right. If I get an email and I put it in a folder, say, tech, it'll show up in a folder. But the other 12 tech emails that are, you know, a month or so older than that, they're not showing up. But they're there.
Well, they're there on your server. They're there on your desktop.
Right.
They're just not on
right.
your phone.
Right.
That's because the phone's only getting new email.
Okay, so what do I need to do? I mean, I talked to Microsoft and Apple and AT&T, and they all said, we don't know.
Well, it's...
So I was turning to you.
Yeah. Apple knows. The guy you talk to at Apple doesn't, but Apple knows. My guess is that Apple has decided, and I don't know why, only to get new email. Now, I would look in your settings to see if you can get, go back farther in time in the settings. Generally, you don't want to do that on a mobile device. You just want the new email. You don't want gigabytes of old email there.
Right.
So, look, I would suspect that if there is a setting for this, you remember that what's odd is it did work in 8, right? In iOS 8, it's just on the iPhone 6 it doesn't work.
And the 5, it worked on the iPhone 5 as well.
I think you have to go to mail settings and say, I want to get more mail. I think it's not getting the old mail. It'd be my best guess. Not sure. Maybe we can get it in the show notes at techguylabs.com. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.